in the trees, but I don't seem to hear them today. I see the sun shining in the sky, but to me the clouds are gray. Many people, many places all around, they remind me of you. Blurry visions through my tears are all I have to see me.
Welcome to another episode of From the Hip, where I get deep and personal with the cream of South Africa's superstars, digging into what makes them tick, the highs and lows, the struggles and achievements, and importantly, why they chose the road of creative arts as a life and career. After 50 years in the music business, you get to know a lot of people, and all of those artists, I respect them as artists. My guest, and also my friend in this episode, is a bit like a diamond, multifaceted. He's a brilliant drummer and vocalist, a Grammy and Oscar-nominated producer who has worked with the best in the business, a successful songwriter. He's directed world-renowned shows and performed for presidents and paupers. Along the way, he's raised a talented family, formed drum workshops, and battled a debilitating condition, all with a sense of humor bar none. Why this artist and my guest has not been inducted with the SAMA Lifetime Achievement Award for his 60 years in South African music is both mystifying and a great injustice. It is indeed a great pleasure to welcome my friend Cedric Sampson to From the Hip. Sid!
Ben, what an intro. I mean, really.
Isn't that a great intro, Sid?
I should have put a red carpet out for you, you know what I mean?
So 60 years and you're still not finished with music.
China, I'm still doing it. You know the drill. It doesn't stop, Ben. You're only as good as your last one, China. You know that.
Well, like I said in the intro, although I've known you for so long, I didn't really realize just how much you've accomplished after reading your bio. It was absolutely amazing. So let's go back. Let's go back to the early days. You were born where, Sid?
I was born in Johannesburg, in Yeovil, China. I grew up in Yeovil with all the gangs and the Lips.
And your dad, Sammy Sampson, of course, was a major name as an impresario and manager. What do you remember of Sammy?
You know what, man? Sammy was my best friend. I mean, he felt it. You know, my mom died giving birth to me and my twin. And so I was kind of brought up by Sammy. And Sammy was just the most wonderful, wonderful spirited human being. And he heard my talent. He said, I'm going to get you a kit of drums. And we got a drum kit. And Sammy said, we're going to rehearse in the boys' club because we got the boxing ring and we got the stage. So we put a little thing together. And that's where Cedric and the Vikings came from. And Sammy just didn't stop helping and managing and putting us out there.
Did the Vikings record anything?
Yes, we did one track. And I was trying to think of the lyric today. The clouds are black and the sun shines all day, something crazy like that. And we were played on LM Radio by Clacky McCabe.
Oh, wow.
And that was it. And then the Vikings broke up. And then, of course, the Fireflies happened.
Now, that's when I first came across you as a member of the Fireflies. And the reason I remember it is I saw the Fireflies at Willamore Park in Benoni. At a session, remember in those days, everything was called a session, right? I remember the band distinctly because I thought, that drummer's really young. I mean,
okay.
Why I remember it so much is the first time I got drunk and I was very young. But that was a great band. I mean, it was you, it was Alan Gold, Goxy Madeira on bass, Errol Friedman on guitar, and also Gary Harrison, who I thought was an amazing guitar player.
Gary was great. He died. Hey, Gary died quite a few years ago, and Alan also died. So you've only got Buzzard left. You've got me, Errol, and Gorks.
Oh, wow. Well, we're going to talk about Buzzard a little bit later because it's one of my favorite South African tracks. Your influences when you were growing up, did you have like set influences as a musician or did they develop as you kind of went along?
You know what, Ben? I would say they developed because, you know, the funny thing is growing up musically, I was genre blind. I listened to everything, you know. And of course, when the band started coming on, when the Fireflies were happening, Jimi Hendrix was happening, the Cream were happening, all the really cool bands. And that's where I started finding my fills and finding drums, just being influenced and listening to, you know, vinyl junkies. mean, like, and yeah, so that, you know, that was my influences. And then, of course, jazz, the fusion stuff I loved, you know, because I loved all the time signatures and speed, just getting your chops together. And yeah, Ben, so it's been quite a trip because some of the bands were pop bands, some of the bands were fusion bands. And that was the thing growing up in the 60s, 70s. And then, of course, I went overseas.
Well, I mean, you had the Fireflies also had a bit of psych in them as well, because Kathy Come Home, which was a massive hit for the Fireflies.
Kathy Come Home.
One of the youngest bands to be signed to a major label, right?
That's right. That's right. Parlophone. That was us. Kathy Come Home, 1968.
And who produced that set?
Now you've got my mind going. Who was at EMI? It was the old EMI studios.
Ian Martin, Alan McGuinness.
I think it was Ian and Alan, if I'm not mistaken.
So the Fireflies hung around for a while, and eventually that split up. And then all of a sudden you pop up in a band called Buzz It. I've got two songs on my system at home. One is Sandy, which was a big hit for you.
Baby, why have you come to see me? You seem so strange, you're out of range, can't understand you. Baby, what you come to tell me? With tears in your eyes, have you come to say goodbye? I've given all my time to you, was that so bad? Can't you realize you're going to make me sad? Sandy, Sandy, tell me, where did we go wrong? Please, 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 say you won't be gone too long. Ah. Sleeping too, it seems you really got a hold on me. Think it over, take your time before you leave. This world for me has always been a happy place. If you leave me, girl, I'll have to hide my face. Sandy, Sandy.
That was a big hit.
And the other is Blurry Visions. What a song.
Oh, Blurry Visions. I haven't heard in so long. Shot for that, Benj. Well, now you've ruined our friendship. I mean,
really. So Buzzard was a three-piece, right? It was you and Errol and Goxie.
And Gawks, yeah.
And what sort of gigs were you doing?
You know what, man? Just the regular sessions. Remember all the Friday night sessions?
Mm.
And then we were doing, of course, all the movie houses. The Piccadilly, Yeovil, the Curzon, Hillbrow, the Clarendon, Hillbrow, the Coliseum, Town, His Majesty's Town. God, I'm even remembering. I'm
and
impressed.
So you played an intermission, right? Like bands, that's when
yes.
bands played. I know.
Absolutely.
It was amazing that, and, wasn't it?
Man, and the Oaks used to grip their teddies while they were watching us.
I see the birds singing in the trees, but I don't seem to hear them today. I see the sun shining in the sky, but to me the clouds are grey. Many people, many places all around, they remind me of you. Blurry visions through my tears are all I have to see me through. Have you ever had the feeling nobody around you really needs you? Nobody to talk to in the dark when you have turned out the lights. Have you ever lost the only real thing you've ever, ever wanted? Seen your dreams smash up in the middle of your life. I never ever knew that the middle of the day could feel so old. I never ever knew that the middle of the nights could feel so cold. Many people, many places all around, they remind me of you. Blurry visions of my tears are all I have to see me.
So you stayed around with Buzzard for a while, but you were always on the move, yes. weren't you, Seth?
Yeah, pretty much, Ben. Pretty much. The move next was I actually wanted to become a session drummer. You know, because I was genre blind, I said, let me give it a shot. And it kind of developed from there. But my best one from the Fireflies, just going a little further, was Scandal.
Mm.
At the branch office.
Right.
That for me was the band, because after the Fireflies broke up, Gary died, just left me Errol and Gawks and the gigs and stuff. But then after that, the LM restaurant in España Cani, where I had to learn to play covers in Italian and all the stuff then with Maria. Don't you remember Maria was an artist?
Oh, she had to clap your hands and stamp your feet.
That was her. Now, she was the singer at the LM restaurant. She was pumping Adolfo Agresti, who was the owner. And so he made her the lead singer, and I became the drummer. And so I had to get scolded every night because I was too loud and I was speeding up and all the shit that goes with it. And that turned me into a drummer, dude, because I started working. I started metronoming, getting my chops together and listening. For me, that was first prize.
It also says on your website that you played for Ballyhoo.
Oh, my God. I forget about Ballyhoo. Ballyhoo was me, Ati,
right.
Paul de Villiers, and Fergie. Yeah, on my website, I think it goes to 70-something.
74.
And 74, and there are four black and white shots of us. And then after that, I worked with Ballyhoo for, I think it was about a year and a half, 2 years. We played in Pretoria.
Mm-hmm.
And then Paul de Villiers went overseas to become the engineer. And then I left Ballyhoo, and I forget who played drums, but I remember Derek Drain joined as a singer.
Right.
And this was at Syros. God, remember Syros?
Yeah.
So, and that's where we played, and then that's where I left Ballyhoo. And then after that, I think it was Scandal. If I'm not
Scandal. Right. Also, but you also had a solo single, Don't You Feel Like Dancing?
Remember that? I mean, shit. I mean, I look at myself now. If looks could kill, I'd get first prize. I was quite handsome then, as a youngster.
But now the label on the record says Muscle Shoals Sound Productions. Was that Muscle Shoals
yes.
in the States?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
You know what, Patrick Van Blerk, who was executive producer, and Julian Laxton, who engineered, they were getting tracks from Muscle Shoals in then. And I got to hear the track, and Patrick said, this is right up your street. Let's do it. And the backtrack was insanely good. And then that was it. And Tonight I Feel Like Dancing did rather well for me, I think.
And then Scandal, of course, had that hit with In the Arms of the Lord. Now Scandal was, I know Nippy Cripple was on bass. Who else was in that
yes.
band?
Well, first Scandal was Barry Irwin on bass. Remember Barry?
Yes, so who joined Freedoms, yeah.
So Barry was on bass, then Barry left to go to Berkeley, and Nippy joined us, and there was still Josh, myself, and Zane Cronier on electric piano. That was the Scandal that actually did rather well. In between Zane, Henny Becker used to come because he wanted to say to us, guys, this is jazz. Let me show you what we do. That's where I learned to play all the fusion stuff was with Henny. And so there was Henny, myself, Josh, and Nippy on certain nights. And then Zane was our permanent keyboard player.
So you were kind of starting already moving into fusion, right? Scandal.
Yes. Oh, and I forget, Arthur Stead was on keys.
Keys, okay.
Before.
Right.
Yeah. Lionel Pelle was on keys. That all the arrangements Gallo. I'm not mistaken.
He was a great keyboard player.
He was amazing. So, yes, between In Scandal, there was Lionel, there was Zane, and then, of course, Henny came on the Sundays to do the jazz thing with us.
So from 1968 to like 74, 75, I mean, you just did not stop. You just kept playing and forming bands, playing with this band, doing this, learning this. Yeah. I mean, it must have been like a plane ride, I mean, of experience.
It hasn't stopped. Since then, it hasn't stopped for 12, nearly 13 years. You know, my epilepsy was seriously bad. And so I kind of stopped all of that, but wanting to play all the time. So that's when all the production started happening for me.
In the early 80s, in fact, in 81, you formed
was Morocco,
which was like a supergroup. Yes. Was you and Joe Arthur, who I think had come out from America at that point. Was it Les Good on bass?
Les on bass, Jet on geet, and John Galanakis was
the
our first. Yeah, and we went to Modesto, California to go and do the debut album.
How did that happen? How did you get from Joburg to California to do an album? Very few South African bands, or any artists for that matter, were recording overseas.
I was working with Dobie Gray, and Dobie's manager was Don Mantero. And Don was quite a wealthy guy. He had wine vineyards in California. And he opened up a studio in Modesto called Villa Recorders. And that's when we went over. You know, we had sponsors. Morocco were quite well in the sponsorship with a couple of guys. And they said, come on, man, let's get you guys over to Modesto and record. Emil Dean was the producer.
You had a big hit single off that one, Bota Boogaloo.
With the made up faces and social graces, I'll show again. In their party suits and their boogie boots, she gets last year's girdle Fabergé. He's got his gray tuxedo and his new toupee. They're away. They're gonna do the bow tie boogaloo. Can't you feel a body sway?
Boogaloo did rather well for us.
Yeah. But you only did one album.
That was it, you know, because we were playing at Peter Desta's place.
Plum Crazy.
That's where we played. We were there for quite a while, but then no one wanted to do covers anymore. And also we were all very involved with session work. And so the band decided, let's leave the live thing and let's become a session group. And that's where it all kicked off, man.
So you were playing sessions, and then suddenly you pop up on Pop Shop.
I remember. Oh God, I forget about.
2 years, God, you had a very successful career hosting South Africa's only pop TV show.
And you know what? I was actually very fortunate, because when I started doing Pop Shop, Sun City had just opened, so all the big artists from Rod Stewart, Bonnie Tyler, Christopher Cross, when they were coming to play Sun City, the first thing was to come on Pop Shop so we could say, how's it? Welcome to South Africa. that was pretty cool for me, Ben. I think I did Pop Shop 3 years.
I watched a clip the other, a couple of clips the other night. You were having a lot of fun, very tongue in cheek.
God, in tonight's lineup, we have Cindy Alter and God, I don't remember who it was, Matt Bianco.
Was it around about sort of 85 when you went to America for an extended period?
That's right. 85. No, it was actually 84. Middle of 84.
Middle of 84.
And then, I was signed to an independent label in New York City. And they said, listen, man, bring all your gear over here. Bring all your furniture. We'll set you up with an apartment. You can start working with a record label. And so I went over. I was there for 5 years. And during the 5 years, I started really doing great productions and working with great artists like Rick Derringer, the Wet 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 producers, Michael Baker, Axel Kroll. And so we put something really cool together. So between them, myself, and then Verdine White from Earth, Wind & Fire joined us. And in between touring, Verdine and I played, what a bass player.
I have to ask you that I picked up something in your bio, is that you were playing at Hugh Hefner's Playboy Club.
Oh, my God. I was a singer.
I want to hear about this, Sid.
I was with my wife in America, Dina Miller. Mm. Dina's dad was Jimmy Miller. Jimmy produced all the Stones, Cream. And so Dina and I were a songwriting team called Familiar Strangers. Mm-hmm. And once again, we were sponsored by a very famous author named Gerald Austin Brown. Mm-hmm. And he fell in love with us and said, listen, okay, guys, we're going to start recording, because we were a songwriting team more than anything else. And then Dean and I split and I was saying, shit, I need work. I was offered a gig at the Playboy Club, at Hefner's Playboy Club. And I thought, fuck it, this will be great. Let me do it. So I get then, I'm working with some of New York's finest singers. You know, I've never really regarded myself the singer. You know, I was a great utility singer for sessions and did that. And so anyway, I get to Playboy Club. Now I'm working 6 nights a week. And, you know, you go to the change room and all the bunnies were there with their trays and everything. I got into such shit. I got fired.
I'm not going to dig any deeper, Sid.
No, please don't.
Now, you worked with Verdine White of Earth, Wind & Fire when the band were kicking at that particular point. How did you manage to hook up with Verdine White?
Verdine and I hooked up through Dobie Gray. And Verdine would come in and out of New York. He took an absolute liking to me. He loved the fact that I was South African. I was this white guy in New York doing the thing and working with some black artists and trying to do that thing. And Verdine said, Sedi, listen, man, I'm going to come to New York and you and I can start working together. Mm-hmm. So I said, cool. And we did a couple of albums together as bass player and drummer. He had nothing to do with production. And then Verdine left because he said, Sedi, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire now starting to tour. But it was great working with. We were still in touch. And then 1989, I was not feeling New York too much. And I came back. And the first project I did getting my production shit together was Wendy Oldfield's Acid Rain.
Great song.
Falling down, burning holes into the ground.
Thing is, Ben, for me, the blessing doing what I've been doing for so many years, I was able to compose, arrange, produce, and play and sing. So, I mean, I was a one-man show with all the artists and bands I worked with. You know, if I needed some really serious players, I'd get them in, because I was never a keyboard player. I was a songwriter at the keyboard. So I'd bring in the real guys to make me look good.
The other thing that came up, which I found quite interesting, was this Zulu rap album that you did, which I think was the first Zulu rap album ever made.
God, Benj, you've done your homework, you old dog. Fuck, I'm impressed. Damn.
How did that come about in the mid-90s? This is very early.
This is while I was still living in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go to a studio called Chung King, which was owned by John King. Mm-hmm. So from, God, 50 Cent, you name all the rappers, that's where they all started. And the recording engineer was Jay Henry. And Jay and I hit it off from day one. So when the Zulu rap album started, I brought John King. It didn't cut it. And I had all these amazing singers and choir people, all my groups from the Soweto gospel choir. Some of them were from there. And Jay Henry came out. And we did the Zulu rap album, Buzz in Africa, in Ntombazana. We did some really nice stuff. And it kind of went sort of-ish here. It didn't really take off here. It did well overseas, you know, just because of the African thing and taking the Western music and putting Zulu rap and Zulu chants. And, it, you know, that started my name. Because of my cross-pollinating different cultures, taking a great pop song and putting a bit of Africa in it, putting a bit of a penny whistle. And so that kind of kicked me off, and that gave me my genre of production.
So now you're back in South Africa, and you moved more from playing sessions and everything to production. The list is very impressive. The 90s were a huge decade for you.
Yeah, it was proper.
You worked with one of the major influences in hip-hop, Ice Cube. Had a number one Billboard hit with Gangsters Make the World Go Round. How did a white boy from Yeovil land up with a hardcore street rapper in America? Tell me about that.
We had the same music attorney in Los Angeles. His name was Lee Young Jr. His pops was Duke Ellington's drummer. And so Lee was very much into the music, and he was helping me with contracts and stuff. And then I went back to South Africa. We stayed in touch. And Cube was coming to South Africa to make a movie called On Dangerous Grounds with Liz Hurley. And Lee said, when you go to Johannesburg, look Cedric up. He's quite a guy musically, and I think you guys will hit it off. So Cube called me during one of his breaks and said, listen, man, I finished filming in the next week. What are the chances of coming over to your studio and we can just talk? I said, let's do it. So he came up to the studio. Of course, Fernando and I had the treehouse. And Cube came up and he said, listen, man, I got this old stylistic track I want to do called People Make the World Go Round, but I want to gangstify it. And what are the chances of recording it? So we recorded it at the treehouse. All the background vocals are said. I did that thing with Cube. Then he took the track back to LA, and that's when Bow Down, that's when West Side Connection, that's what they call themselves, and the album was called Bow Down. And then what happened is Cube sent me the track with all three of them on, and we mixed it at the Treehouse and mastered it. Gavin Lewson mastered it in Los Angeles. And the next thing I know, Cube calls me up. He says, yo, Samson, he said, look at the Billboard charts. We're number one. And we were number one for 8 weeks.
That's amazing, Sid.
Yeah, it's crazy. Hey? And Gangsters Make the World was the title track for the album, which I didn't even think about. I just thought, hey, man, it's a job. Let me do it. I'm getting my production chops together. And that was it. And Cube and I stayed in touch. And what an amazing guy. He's hardcore. He's a softy, man. He's a complete softy.
You tend to find that with these guys, isn't it? I mean, that they really are quite soft on the inside.
And Cube was quite a family guy, you know. So, but his hardcore image worked for him right across the board, you know. And then he became quite a big movie star. And then his kind of music fell to the wayside a bit. But what a trip working with him, and what a trip knowing I'm sitting in Joburg. And the next thing, wait, China, this is the best one. I get a DHL package. And I'm going, what the hell is this? So I open it up, and there is a gold album, West Side Connection, 500,000 sales. And then there's a platinum one that says 1 million sales. So I've still got those beautiful pics of the guys in my little rehearsal room. And it's just wonderful to have been able to work with Cube and the other guys.
Things that you did in the 90s. Okay, a Grammy nomination, right, for Best Song Written for a Documentary or Film for the song Father of Our Nation featuring Masekela and Jennifer Jones. And that was for the Mandela documentary, is that right?
That's right. That was for Father of a Nation.
Right.
And that was produced by Joe Mennell and Angus Gibson.
Right.
All of these projects happened at the Treehouse, excluding Heaven is Right Here on Earth, which we didn't bop when you and I worked with Little Sister.
Yeah.
So the Grammy came about. I mean, once again, I get a call that says, Sid, you know you've been nominated Best Song for Motion Picture. I said, you've got to be kidding me. And you've got to fly to New York to the Grammys. Mm-hmm. So Francie and I went. And sitting there doing the thing. Actually, we were at the table with Sting. We all had a table together doing that thing. And then I didn't win the Grammy. R. Kelly beat me with I Believe I Can Fly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that the same song that was used in the Mandela documentary where you got an Academy nomination?
Yes.
So you got a Grammy nomination and an Academy nomination?
The Academy nomination was for the flick. And obviously, my entire score was part of that, which people recognize what I did then. But the Academy went to Joe and Angus, and of course, with a soundtrack. And writing about Madiba was quite a trip. What an incredible human being.
You obviously met him, right?
We were quite good friends with Tata. Right. He used to call me Kojak. You know, he'd say to me, "Sir Kojak, it's good to see you." And I tell you how we got to meet Madiba. Matthew, who's now 32, Maddie and Mbuso, Madiba's grandson, were best friends. And they were at nursery school together. And Maddie broke his leg at the president's house. That's what
Wow.
And we had to go and fetch and do all that stuff. And Madiba felt so bad, he used to come visit Matthew at the house where my Treehouse studio was.
Right, I remember Treehouse.
And he'd sit and he loved his rooibos tea. And he'd sit for a couple of hours and tell us prison stories. And it was quite shocking what went on. But anyway, that's how I got to write Father of Our Nation.
What do you think of the song?
He absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. you know, and what he really wanted. I'm just moving backwards and forwards.
Sure.
On Father of Our Nation, it was his 90th birthday at the Joburg Stadium. And he wanted the song that I wrote for him. He said, I'd like it played for me. So I had 3 days just before his 90th to rehearse 78 people for the performance.
Woof.
I had the 40-piece Soweto Gospel Choir. I had my 12-piece band. I had djembe players. I had three of my favorite backup singers. And then, of course, we had Vicky. We had Jennifer Jones, Vicky Sampson, Tandiswe, Judith Supuma, and Josie Fields. On the stage, I'm sure you've seen the vid, and Madiba sitting like 10 feet away from me, looking and smiling. He had Grasser next to him and Paolo Jordan. And we must have had 60,000 odd people there. And a guy named Clive Morris Productions, Clive did the entire filming. And there was a guy named Johan van der Kolff who did the live engineering, which I thought he did an amazing job. And it was just such a trip to be musical director for Madiba for his 90th. For me, it's the best honor I've ever had in my life to work with that man. And take my musical career after so many years and put it on that stage and perform. Because you know me, Benj, I've loved to perform my whole life. Even in the studio, I'm performing when I'm not working.
So you've got a Grammy nomination, you've got an Academy yes. nomination, and then you top it off by getting an Emmy nomination for the Mandela and de Klerk film with Sidney Poitier and Michael Caine.
Joe Sargent and Cedric Scott, LA guys. Joe Sargent was one of the biggest directors in Hollywood, Cedric producer. And once again, they heard about me through Lee Young Jr. And of course, they also knew about the thing I did for Madiba. And when they came to South Africa, they came up to the treehouse and they said, okay, man, we've heard your scoring. Would you do the score for us? And I said, absolutely. I think we worked in the studio for 3 weeks. I must have done about 30 cues for the film. And, you know, the cool thing about what I started learning as a producer, songwriter in the studio was to take variations of a theme. So, and that's how I started writing. And the funny thing is I write the same song all the time with artists in terms of bookends. Here's your intro, there's your verse, there's your pre-chorus, your chorus. Let's maybe go to a solo, go to intro. So I've worked that way my entire life. So that's been my thing musically. And when I worked with people, like even when I did the George Benson, Patti LaBelle, Harlem Boys Choir, Miriam Makeba, Candice Love, who else? Melanie Daniels. These were all big singers in New York. You know, same thing. I wrote with a lady named Denise Rich. Denise wrote all Luther Vandross's big hits and Patti LaBelle's big hits. And we hooked up in New York and she said, shit, let's do this. And I'm moving backwards and forwards again. But that project happened while Fran and I and the family were living in Los Angeles. I get a call at 3 o'clock one morning and hello, is this Cedric? I said, yes. He says, this is King Mswati III from Swaziland. And he says, I want to talk to you because, you know, we have a major epidemic in Swaziland, an AIDS epidemic. And under the Royal Initiative to Combat AIDS, I put an album together for him called Songs for Life. It took me 2 years, but it was a double album, and everyone was on it. I mean, they had different producers, but I had to oversee and make sure that the shows were going to happen. And that's how I got to meet Denise Rich, because I thought, okay, these are really cool songs everyone's doing. We need a title track that's going to launch the album. So Denise and I wrote a track called Sacred Pledge, which is all about kids, all about the pandemic, or everything that wasn't good at that period, we made good through music. And that kind of really, really set me off, Benj. You know, and George Benson and I are still buddies. He's very old. Mm. He's old now.
Mm.
But it was such a trip to work with all of those people. And Miriam McKebber. Oh, my God. Miriam. I mean, we had a Grammy nomination for Miriam's album that I produced called Homeland.
I think what sets you aside in music is your ability to sort of almost seamlessly move between styles and projects. You've done jazz records, you've done world music records, you've done what I call cause records. You've done soundtrack stuff. I mean, you did The Lost City, which you did with Jean-Michel Jarre.
Jean-Michel.
Yeah, The Lost City. Wow. You co-wrote and arranged and produced the opening of The Lost City. People of the South, you wrote the oh theme for that. Drum, the movie.
Ben, you know more than I do.
The Drum movie was the first South African black directed film. I mean, so
That's right.
Of that. Working with McKebba, because I mean, your production CV is awesome, but let's talk about a few you produced. I mean, the two icons of South African music, world music, Mama Miriam McKebba, and jazz trumpeter Hugh Masekela. Starting with Miriam, you co-wrote and arranged and produced the Homeland album. How did you meet Miriam and to come about to produce that album?
Through Bra Hugh. Because remember, I did Hugh's album first, his Notes of Life album.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a record, man. When I listened to the production, I listened the other day. It was a beautiful album, and maybe the best flugelhorn player on the planet.
Mm.
And we did an amazing album. And he said, you know, Miriam's coming back. You should meet her. And Miriam absolutely fell in love with me. And likewise. And she said, I want to do an album. And, you know, we got finance to do the album. It was an expensive album then, Benz. It was half a bar then.
Right.
You know, because I flew people from all over the world to work with her. Lokwa Kanza came in from the DRC. Jay Henry came in from Las Vegas. God, who else was there? There were quite a few. I just can't think of all the names. But anyway, working with Miriam, we put all the tracks together, just, you know, rough them out. We worked at the Leading Edge studio because that's where we actually, you know, generally we used to go and rehearse when, like, I'd worked with you with Little Sister. Mm. We'd rehearse the tracks, go to the studio, record. With Miriam, we wrote in the studio. That was a 3-month project, all in. And of course, everyone come in and work with her. But Miriam, oh my word, what an incredible, incredible artist, singer. And what an honor it was to work with this lady. So we did the Homeland album. Next thing we knew, it was nominated for a Grammy Best World Music Album. that's yours. So I think it was a Putumaya album. And then the next thing, Miriam and I started doing shows together, and people were asking about Miriam. What are the chances of Miriam coming to America to play the Hollywood Bowl? And I said, shit, are you kidding me? Okay, so what did we do? We put an entire rehearsal together. Now, at that stage, I just moved to Los Angeles. That was 2000. And if I'm not mistaken, we recorded Miriam's album 1998, and she got the Grammy nomination when we were playing, when we did the Hollywood Bowl. The first night we started, I got word that Miriam had a Grammy nomination for Homeland, which we announced on stage. But I've got to tell you, working with Miriam, we had one day to rehearse the 90-piece Philharmonic Orchestra that was backing Miriam's entire show.
Wow.
And it was insane. We had 15,000 people a night for three nights, sold out. And during the first performance, I brought her a note on stage, and she said, oh, a Grammy nomination for Homeland. And since then, until she died, we were good friends. We were, in fact, I would say Miriam's album for me, in terms of African and Africa, is the best project I've done.
It was, you know, her last album, wasn't it?
It was her last album, yes, yes.
Working with Brahe, was he as difficult as some people say he was?
No, he was an absolute gentleman. Coming up to the studio, he just loved what Seddy was proposing to him. And I tell you what, Hugh was one take musician. Mm. I've never heard anyone to get into a studio and play his flugel trumpet the way he played, with such notation and such perfection and tuning. Because, you know, you always have a tuning issue with horn sections or penny whistles in an ensemble. Mm-hmm. But when we did the track, the album with Hugh, he had the finest musicians. And I've just got to say, while we're talking about musicians, you know, I went overseas to go and work with the best and do all that. We have the best in our country. They don't beat them like we have. From the Tembo Mkhizes to the Lucas Senyatas to the Kwazi, the drummers, to all the singers, we honestly have and then had the best players. And how we put the African stuff together and westernized it so globally people would dig what it's about. And that worked. And that's why Brahe, for me, I never had an issue with Hugh, ever. You know, he was on time, we recorded, we had worked like an 8-hour day. And, you know, he'd like to have his scotch afterwards and do the thing. But I never found Hugh difficult at all.
And you were working at the Treehouse, your studio in Norwood.
Treehouse, yes. The Treehouse just became the studio of note. I got a call from a guy named Lindsay Scott. And he said, you know, I'd really like to meet you because my artist is here in Cape Town. We just came to Cape Town to have a look and see, because she wanted to come on holiday. And I said, well, who's your artist? He said, Jennifer Rush. I said, you got to be kidding. So Treehouse, once again, Healing Power, Crater, which was her lead track for her album called Crater. And I recorded all that at the Treehouse.
And who else did you record at the Treehouse? I mean, it was a great studio. I remember coming to it a number of times.
Little room, I mean, was on top of the garage, but it was just properly decked out. It sounded good, acoustics were good. And it became a very popular studio. And that's when, of course, Ice Cube and then Jennifer Rush and then the Americans to come do the Sydney Poitier, Michael Caine, Mandela and de Klerk. It didn't stop, Inch. It didn't stop. And I think the one time when I took a break was to go with you to work on the Little Sister album, which
'92.
And I still, Tim and I still listen to Peace on Earth.
Great song.
It's still one of the best tracks I've ever done. It just had that thing.
I think what you did with Little Sister, I mean, we had success with the first album, but it was quite a sort of generic sound, the first album is More Than Meets the Eye has a lot of light and shade on that record.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, I think the addition of Tim Hoare on keyboards, who I think is a monster player, and I know you still work with him. I mean, the songs, Peace on Earth, that middle section with that piano solo is just unbelievable. Oh.
Said to Tim, you know, because Tim and I jam every Sunday, you know, and Tim and I have been working together for 42 years.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy, hey? You know, I drowned last year. I literally drowned. I had a grand mal seizure while I was swimming. A homeless guy picked me out of the water 7 feet out. I woke up in ICU 2 days later. My lungs were filled with sand, water. I was gone, properly. And the one paramedic said to my wife, your husband must be a very fit man because he would not have made this.
Was that an epileptic fit?
Yeah, complete, yeah. My epilepsy is not great, Benj. Mm. You know, I always joke about it, but I put on a great show live at Caesar's Palace. I mean, it's a hell of a show.
I said
But the only problem is, you know, my wife's so sucked for my routine now, she's my only audience. So I was thinking, all right, let me get Grant Van Zyl, put some lighting, some sound, and while I'm frothing at the mouth and rigor mortis, you can have some kick-ass music playing.
Well, as long as I've known you, Sid, you always laugh at things. also work together on a couple of things. I mean, we did Wire to the Floor together.
Don't get caught between the art and the dollar.
In the 2010s, we worked on that very strange project by E. Solo.
Oh, my word. Remember that?
Yes.
You've got an amazing memory.
The memory I have of it is it turned out that E. Solo, who was a rapper, was actually Ernie Lasterch Solomons.
Solomon, exactly.
Who was involved with, I think, the 28s in Cape Town.
That's him. That's him.
So
that's
he was him. A hard... Was a in fact, he was assassinated, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's him. I mean, he'd arrive at the studio with bags of cash.
Yes, I know.
That's how he operated. It was crazy.
And you put that track together from scratch, right?
From scratch, yeah. You know, he said, no, man, I won't do rap. And I've got this thought. And he was completely tone deaf.
Right.
And so, and once again, to me and my friends that come in as serious session musicians and make the project sound amazing.
Mm.
And that for me, just changing once again, that for me has been my success, is bringing in the South African guys that are really shit hot and can make the project and the song sound great. You get the arrangements right with them. I always say to them, less is more, and that's how we get it.
What makes a great producer?
First prize is homework. You have to do your homework on what the artist is about, what the voice is about, what the tone is about, what the vibrato is about, the light and shade. That, for me, kicks off for the artist. Then, of course, you've got the musicians, and I would work with the musicians in the studio and show them the light and shade. That's the first role of a producer. Then, of course, you've got the vocal arrangement, and that, for me, has been my key to the world, is my work with choirs and backup singers. It's really, you know, and I listened to Hugh's album, you know, because I know he's going to talk with you this morning. Shit, I was so nervous. I didn't sleep last night. I'm going, shit, I'm going to be with Benji on the phone. Let me have a couple of smokes quickly.
Boy. So when you go into or take on a production project,
yes.
do you have a clear-cut idea of what you want to do, or do you have a skeleton and then you flesh it out as you go along?
Sometimes a skeleton. Mainly, I knew what I wanted for the artist, and I'd go through it with him. You know, like when we worked with Little Sister, I mean, we went in, we had basic tracks, and we built it as we were going along. That was the skeleton.
Mm.
When I was working with people that didn't have a whole lot of time to get a record going, I would do my homework and come in completely prepared. You know, and it's a funny thing because people say, oh, you got so lucky. And I said, you know what luck is? Luck is when preparedness meets opportunity. And I have six keywords. I say, if you've got passion, precision, love, energy, professionalism, and most important, discipline. The world's your oyster, China.
Are you a prescriptive producer? It's like, this is how it's going to be.
To a point, because I know records and I know how songs are produced.
Hmm.
And of course, I've gone to sessions where some of my producer friends have been working and learnt, you know, because Ben, you never stop learning,
no.
China.
No.
You're only as good as your last one. You know the drill.
Hmm.
I go in prepared. That's part of my drill. From vocals, obviously working on the keys. Like Miriam, when we did, some of the keys were way too high for Miriam when we were writing in the studio. We brought Lokwakhanza in from the DRC, who co-wrote a few tracks with Miriam. The album, once again, is a magnificent record that portrays South African product completely. Mm. Miriam's album was the best I've done in terms of production. And even though we wrote in the studio, I would take my notes all the time. I'd always have my foolscap book with me, and I always had my notes. I always put a diagram of what the track was going to be in little boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Intro, first verse, you know, in that, like I did with Little Sister. And on the left side of the page, I'd put all the instrumentation down that I like. And that's how I started working. And that's what got me the thing that I started doing later on in life.
What are you doing now, Sid? I mean, you've got this amazing career behind you. What are you doing now? What keeps you going?
Benj, what keeps me going now is I've got an amazing family, you know, because they've been so supportive of me, because my health isn't great. I'm up and down. I mean, I could have four seizures in one hit and be unconscious for an hour and wait for paramedics. I mean, but since I'm on new meds, I may be having 2-3 a month, you know. So in between all of these things, I've started my life documentary. And we've kind of 3 months in it now of just planning, writing, getting DOPs, camera crew, do all that stuff. I'm working with an incredible lady called Hazel Friedman. Hazel came to my 70th in August, and I didn't even realize, you know, it was going to be such an event. I thought I'll just have my family and a couple of friends. I had the whole of Hot Bay there. Deus even ran out of food and booze. There must have been four, I swear to God, there must have been 400 people there. Hazel Friedman was busy filming, and I didn't think anything of it. And there was Wendy Oldfield, there was Robin Auld, there was Dali Tambo came down to host my 70th. And so getting back to the documentary, so Hazel came, said, check this out, man. I've done this little thing for your 70th. And she said, I've gone through your website and your work, and you're an icon here. You're a legend drummer. Let's do something. So we started. So my docu's going to be called Relentlessly Yours. So I thought it was a good title.
Yes, you know? Definitely.
And that's how we started getting my documentary together, because we found clips and stuff, Benji. I mean, I've archived pretty much my entire life, not knowing it. I have all these boxes in my rehearsal studio. And when I open the first box, what's the first CD that comes out? Little Sister. And then from there, it's been endless, Benji. So my main thing right now is, because of my health issues and because I keep as fit as I do, I can't go very far. I don't drive. I'm not allowed to drive, you know, because I can have a seizure at the wheel. I mean, I had one in my road going to the beach. I could be talking to you now and just disappear. That's grand mal seizures and petit mals. Petit mals are shitty. You remember Steve Spannenberg?
Yes, very well.
Steve and I talk all the time, and we were talking about how his son died. You know, he was having like 17 petit mals every day.
Oh, wow.
And that wipes you out, Ben. You know, and like I said, I'm so thrilled that I'm fit, because when I have a seizure, it takes me a day to recover completely. I can't walk. I've got no balance. My speech is impaired. I shake like a leaf. Good for my single roles when I play drums. Otherwise, not. So that's what I'm working on now, Benjamin. I'm just taking life a little easy. I've got a couple of projects on the go. I did a project a couple of months ago for the Hilton College, you know, the Hilton College in KwaZulu-Natal. I was asked by a young guy named Sipo Mkhize if I would come and rehearse and produce and record the choir. So we went up to, I went up there, and what a great recording. And, you know, we worked in the auditorium. A couple of the young guys, they didn't know what they are. I had to guide and show them a couple of things, and worked with the Hilton Boys College Choir. And, you know, for me, that was a great thing, because I gave youngsters an opportunity to show themselves. You know, that's like when I started a couple of years ago, my LOVE project, and the acronym of LOVE, Life, Opportunity, Vision, Enhancement. It was about empowering and working with new kids on the block that didn't have the funding to do it. And so that's what I've been doing for quite a few years. And right now I want to concentrate on the documentary, because I don't mean to be crazy about this, but Benja, I live life day at a time. I never know when I'm going to go.
Well, I tell you, Sid, I am so looking forward to the documentary. You can relive Cedric's amazing journey and career on his website at cedricsamson.co.za. No P. Don't forget, it's not Samson with a P.
No P. No, that's Vicky. Talking about Vicky, Vicky also traveled a lot with me overseas. Mm. We went to India together. I went to Mumbai to go and work with the best of India, because they had a major AIDS pandemic with kids. So I went over to go and work with the best of India, from sarangi players to sitar players to tabla players to the alap singers, you know, all the Indian scales that the males
pentatonic
and
scales
do.
Yeah.
Pentatonic scales. And I fused that Vicky was singing, and then I came back and put my African artists on, and I had the Indians in between. Mm. It's on my website. It's the song's called One Life. So, yeah, I would say there's been so much, man, but you know what? Every project for me has been a great project. I can never say this one was better than that. I just went with my flow. But in terms of artists, when you work with the Bra Hughes and you work with the Miriam McKebbers and you work with the George Bensons and the Patti LaBelles, they are one-take people, Benj. I've never seen anything like it.
What a journey, Cedric. What a journey. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Oh, my channel.
Just keep playing music, man. Thanks, Ed.
Cheers, Benj. God bless.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.